Concerns continue in the state over the quality of Iowa's water, both at home and downstream. What are farmers doing about it? It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Clay Masters, sitting in for Ben Kiefer today. This hour, a shrimper from Louisiana concerned about his livelihood and the growing dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico gets a firsthand look at an eastern Iowa farmer's land. They talk about Iowa agriculture's impact on the dead zone and learn more about each other's operation. Then the two sit down for a conversation in front of an audience at Big Grove Brewery I moderated in Iowa City. It's the third installment of Public Radio on Tap, recorded last week, part of our series of conversations about water quality in the state. The two are also joined by an engineering professor at the University of Iowa and another farmer from central Iowa. That conversation after this news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
Good afternoon. It's a special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Clay Masters in for Ben Kiefer today. We're listening to a conversation about water quality, recorded last week in front of a live audience at Big Grove Brewery in Iowa City. This hour, you'll hear from panelists Larry Weber, who's Executive Associate Dean at the College of Engineering and Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of Iowa, Thomas Olander, a shrimper from Louisiana, and two Iowa farmers, Kelly Blair of Dayton in central Iowa, and Mitchell Hora of Washington County, who serves on his County Farm Bureau Board. Before we dig into that conversation, let's take a quick listen to a visit I took earlier that day to Mitchell's farm, where the Louisiana fisherman got his first tour of an Iowa farm.
So that it's supply and demand. The supply is super high. Demand continues to go up, but the supply is going nuts. So that's what we're looking at is how do we get more of the economics back to the farm? Where right now you get, and so you get such a small margin, how do you get more of that and cut out the other pieces that are all, they're all taken there. They got their hand in the
cookie jar. Wouldn't it be better if y'all grew less and put less on the market and drove the price back up?
Right.
And so, you have less expenses, less wear and tear because you're farming less.
Right. I mean,
wouldn't that work? And then you're using less fertilizer.
So the big key there is that almost 60% of Iowa farmland is rented. So you have that rent expense every year. Some of it, I think the average now is about $230 an acre rent. Some of it would be up to $300.
And who you rent it from? The state itself?
No, landowners.
Yeah, it's so like back home.
Little old ladies.
I'm just wondering if it was landowners here also.
So this is all private. Yep, all private owned. Yep.
That was a conversation between Louisiana shrimper Thomas Olander and Iowa farmer Mitchell Hora. And now to our discussion at Big Grove, where I began by asking each of the panelists their number one concern when it comes to water quality. Here's Mitchell.
So I guess like on the farm, my number one concern about water quality is how are we able to utilize the effort that the whole group is making and all of you are a part of in order to help our operations to be more sustainable long term, in order to help global agriculture and to be able to tie all of us together. And that's why I'm excited to have Tom here with us too, that we are all connected in this. And if we can help to move progress forward so it works for all of us, that's really my aim here, is if we can find the conglomeration so that we can all succeed. And I think we all have a piece in that, and I'm excited to see where that conversation goes tonight on how we can all have our part.
Thomas?
First of all, I'd like to say I want to thank IPR for inviting me to come up here and speak what's going on with our situation in the Gulf of Mexico. I do believe after meeting with Mitchell today, which I really enjoyed, and I believe I found a new friend here, we share a lot of same interests. We want to see a future in the both industries, in the farming industry and the fishing industry. And we believe that working together, we can get something done. Our scientists back home tell us that studies the dead zone, actually the dead zone out there, tells us if we could just get at least a 10% cutback in the amount of fertilizer that's coming down the Mississippi River, it would make a major impact on the shrimping industry. So if we could just at least start with 10% and then work from there, that would be a big help that would go a long ways in the shrimping industry.
And we'll go now to Kelly from Dayton, Iowa. Go ahead.
Thanks. I farm corn, soybeans, cattle, and pigs with my husband and two kids in Dayton, Iowa, just south of Fort Dodge. And the one thing that concerns me about water quality is just that the fact that it doesn't really look like farmers are doing a whole heck of a lot, but as being a part of ag, I open up the newspapers and the farm magazines, and there's always an article about water quality, soil quality, and on our farm, it's a pretty big deal, continual improvement and conservation, but it's not instantaneous, so we're gonna keep working at it, and we need to keep the conversation going.
Larry?
As a lifelong Iowan, it's really important for me to think about a balance between agricultural, economic, human, natural, and water resources for the long-term viability of our state. And part of, you know, that balance has to be monitoring and a fair evaluation of the scientific data of the, you know, concentrations and loads of this, you know, agricultural pollutant leaving the state of Iowa.
As these two alluded to earlier in the day, I was able to tag along as Thomas got a tour of Mitchell's farm. And before we talk about that visit, you know, Thomas learned a lot about Iowa farming. I didn't learn a whole lot about shrimping while I was there because you were there to learn from him. But I'm curious for a crowd here in Iowa, you know, we talk about the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico a lot in this state. But we don't see the impact like you do. Put this into perspective for us and tell me about your industry.
Well, the dead zone, you know, there's a somewhat of a misinterpretation. When people hear about the dead zone, they automatically think of dead seafood. Well, we don't really have dead seafood. It doesn't kill any fish. It doesn't kill any shrimp. None of that stuff actually dies. What happens is as it grows out there in the Gulf of Mexico, it leaves those areas and it moves inshore waters. Where our shrimp, and we in the shrimping business, and this is where our shrimp are laid, the big shrimp lay the small ones, and they begin to grow in the inland waters. Well, because of the dead zone effect out there, all the fish that normally feed, like your sharks, your porpoises, your offshore saltwater, deep saltwater fish that normally fish out and survive to feed out there, they're all moving further inshore now, and they're actually competing against me for the same product. They have to survive. So we're seeing such an impact of sharks that is eating up so much shrimp and other fish are too. I mean, they all having to survive because all your big fish are going to follow the bait. They're not just going to look for just certain areas to be in. They're just looking to survive. And with all that in our inland waters now the sharks, because we got so many more sharks now, when we're fishing those nets and we catch sharks in our nets, and as soon as that webbing touches the end of their nose, is a reaction that takes place on that shark, and he bites a big old hole in our nets because our nets are made out of plastic. And when we pick up and we got shark holes all over the net, it shuts us down 2-3 hours. Not only that, we're dealing with that. All your bigger boats, your much larger boats that fish strictly the Gulf of Mexico because of the dead zone has grown so much, they're also moving further inshore. And now we're not only competing against inland boats, but we're also competing against offshore boats that's trapped to the same crop that we're after. It would be like some catastrophe happened in Iowa and all the farmers had to come to Washington County and farm. That would put y'all all down to probably about 2 acres of land and trying to survive and feed your family on 2 acres. And that's basically what we're dealing with. Our pie has shrunk so much because we have such competition now with the seafood itself and from other boats fishing also.
And describe to the industry, the shrimping industry in your part of the country.
The shrimping industry in Louisiana is over a $1 billion industry. And back in 2000, Louisiana Wildlife and Fishery had put out a report that there was over 16,000 commercial fishermen. 16 years later, they put out another report and we down to a little over 5,000. So it's an industry that we're losing, and we're losing it quick. I'm not against studies, but we've been studying the dead zone for over 30, maybe 40 years now. We've been studying the dead zone out there. We all know the effects of it already by now. What we need now is more solutions to help this industry. It's an industry that if we don't soon get some help, and I mean not 10 years down the road, within the next 2-3 years, if we don't get a lot of help,
this industry, the way we're depleting in fishermen, commercial fishermen, we won't have an industry. And we take such a pride in putting a great product on the plates of American families, and we want to keep that tradition. My son got into this business. He's the same age as Mitchell here, and I had bought him a shrimp boat out after high school, and he was only able to stay in it for like 2 years, and I had to sell the boat because we just could not sustain a living anymore. And you know, he's so heartbroken because he had to get out of it to survive. And I'm a fourth generation fisherman, and we're the last of them. We do not see any 30-year-olds, 20-year-old fishermen in this business at all. It's just not sustainable anymore.
So Thomas says he's looking for solutions. When we look upstream where we are right now, Larry, what are some of the solutions?
Well, you know, I think the solutions, you know, really start, you know, across a broad spectrum of changes that need to be made in this agricultural system. We have a two-crop system. We have a lot of tile drainage installed. We have a very leaky system. We have a lot of fertilizer that gets applied, animal manure that's being applied as a fertilizer. And we're seeing our loads increase. And I think the key point that Thomas made is that we've got to start making progress. And I think in Iowa, we need to start focusing on this issue and starting to work with a sense of urgency. The Gulf Hypoxia Task Force came out in the early 2000s and suggested that we needed a 45% reduction in nutrient load to the Gulf by 2015. 2015 has come and gone, and not only are we not yet seeing a decrease, it's still going up. The data in Iowa that we've just published a paper on shows that we have a 47% increase in nitrate load leaving Iowa from 2003 to 2016, rather than a 45% reduction. We've got to start taking this more serious. We've got to work with more urgency, and we've got to, you know, take ownership of the issue that we have in the state.
And certainly the two farmers here in Iowa that we have on the stage right now are taking it very seriously. I'm interested to ask Mitchell and Kelly, individually, what was it that made it an important decision for you to implement the different kind of water conservation systems that you have on your farm? And Kelly, we can start with you.
We like to look at research and we like to look at data. And so in order to make those changes, we need to know that our profitability on our farm is not going to go down, or what we're doing on our farm is not going to affect the yield. And so, you know, we need to look at all of that before we can make a decision. Environmentally, we know from research that less tillage is better for our soils and thus better for our water. And then, you know, as a parent, time is pretty important too for me. So it's less time doing that tillage. So it was a pretty easy decision to make over the whole farm. We're done. Cover crops is a little different story. We know that it's good for water quality and for our soils, but it also costs to put those in, and it could affect our cash crop. So we need to look at all those in order to implement it. It's not a simple decision to, you know, just reduce fertilizer or anything like that. There's a lot of research that we need to look at, and we need to test on our own farm to make those decisions.
Mitchell?
This leads right into one of my biggest takeaways for tonight, is that as farmers, we understand these practices that has been laid out in the nutrient reduction strategy of reduced tillage, get more cover crops out there, improve nutrient efficiency or nutrient optimization. We understand those things, and I think we want to do them, but it boils down to how do I logistically and economically make it work. So like on Kelly's farm, they said, hey, here's some of this reducing tillage. Can we do that on our farm? Let's test it in our own trials. Here's some of our neighbors, or here's the Iowa State research, or whoever, Iowa Soybean, who is doing research. We'll learn from what they did, but let's try it on our farm. Let's try small scale. Let's try what our neighbors did, and let's see how it works for us. We have to logistically change our mindset. We have to logistically change our equipment, which is super expensive. And we have to get into a new system. Then, like she said, how does that affect the economics? The on-farm economics right now are not good. So like for you guys, if you were going to take an economic risk that you could go and lose money by trying something new, that makes you step back and think about it a little bit. And when you're talking about a lot of money, that it's going to take to do this, that makes you take a big step back and say, okay, let me baby step into this. Let me figure out what's going to work best for my operation. Try small scale, see how it works, learn, then boom, go. The good thing is we've been learning. Now we're getting to the boom, go part.
So looking for solutions, Larry, the nutrient reduction strategy out of Iowa State University, something that was done with the Iowa DNR and the state government and the Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship, a pretty hefty goal, and we talked about it a little bit earlier, but we're nowhere near that goal. And when we're looking for solutions to be imminent, how do you move at a rapid pace?
Well, you know, I think one of the real shortcomings is funding. You know, we've talked about that before. The economy on the farm is very difficult with low commodity prices today. And so, you know, there needs to be cost share and incentive programs to help, you know, landowners take on these practices that don't have the agronomic benefit that improved soil health does. So the edge of field things like bioreactors and saturated buffers, construction of large nutrient removal wetlands, those are going to take, you know, some cost share to get those implemented. We've estimated that across the 1,600 watersheds in Iowa, we need about $3 million invested for water quality improvements and about $3 million invested for flood damage reduction in each of those watersheds. That's $4.8 billion plus $4.8 billion. You know, that's a $10 billion issue. Seems like a lot of money, but if we think of it in the context of, you know, the Iowa's water and land legacy, which would be a 3/8 cent sales tax increase, generates about $180 million, and round numbers, we'll call it 200. If we put $200 million a year into these conservation programs, we could get to $10 billion in 50 years. And so if you think back 50 years ago to, you know, what was happening on the farm, we had a lot of soil loss. The Soil Conservation Commission came in, they implemented practices to reduce that soil loss, and we've changed the way soil comes off the land in 50 years. We could do the same thing with nutrients and the same thing with water in the next 50 years, but we got to get serious about it. That means our legislature has to move forward with Iowa's water and land legacy. We've got to get this money into the system, and then we have to have farmers accept that cost share funding into practices on their land. And, you know, and I think that would be the real test.
Iowa State University takes a look at the amount of land in Iowa that is farmed, and the latest figure is that 56% of Iowa's land, farmland, is rented, that's leased. And I know, Kelly, the land that you farm is leased. I'm curious, when we have these conversations about water quality, we have them a lot about the farmer doing this, the farmer doing that. Should this be more of a question of the landowner and their role in this?
I think it's going to take both. We're lucky on our farm that, you know, majority of the land that we farm is rented, it's leased. But the landowners that we work with are willing to have a relationship with us to understand what we're doing on the farm and to have also make that commitment to help us out when times are tough. You know, we're not probably the one that people come to in our area for the highest paid rent. We're the ones that people come to in our area for conservation. And so the landowner, I think it's kind of a hard position to be in, because if you just want the check at the end of the day as a landowner, it makes it really hard as the farmer to really put a lot of effort into making that soil better and that type of thing. So it really needs to be both of us having the conversation together and keeping it going.
That it does have to be a farmer and landowner conversation. In our own experience, literally just last night, so I farm with my father. He was at one of our landlord's family's farms last night, talking to, it's an older guy and his wife and all their kids, and none of them are involved in ag anymore. They've retired now from agriculture, but dad went to their farm last night to talk about our lease. It's not a huge farm, about 120 acres, and they were talking about cover crops. And now in their lease going forward, that's gonna be a piece of the agreement. Is, hey, let's figure out our rent and make sure that the economics work out, because rent is super high. I think the average now is about $240 per acre. So if we can play with that a little bit, that can give us some of the economics to make it work for our operation. And we were able to make that conversation happen. We've been using cover crops on that farm already, but now we're able to work with the landowner to make sure that that continues going forward. Having them involved, having them with a vested interest that, hey, we want to improve this land, and we approve of you using cover crops to do it, and we're gonna support you in that effort. But in order to have that conversation, it has to come from both directions. Like I said, the majority of the people in that conversation are the landowner, because 56% of it is rented. And so we've got to have the landowners involved in making that happen. One thing we're looking at doing is, how do I improve the value of farmland with soil health practices? We can improve farmland. We can improve the structure. We can improve the biology on the farm. We can improve the soil fertility so it can be sustainable in the long term. We're now able to do that with these practices that we're implementing. That's where we can have the conversation with the landowner to say, hey, I want to do things better. Help me to do that economically, and I will help you to improve the value of your piece of farmland. And that's huge for leaving a legacy long term.
And I think one of the other challenges when we think about improving the farmland in terms of value is there's been a lot of drainage tile installed in the state of Iowa over the last several years. And, you know, with the flooding that's happened in eastern Iowa and throughout much of Iowa, we get asked a lot, what is the impact of agricultural draining on flooding? And we've done a lot of study on that. And the short answer is it depends. That's very complicated. It depends on previous rain conditions, antecedent soil moisture conditions, on and on and on. If someone asks us, what is the impact of tile drainage on nitrate, then it no longer depends, because the analysis that we're doing in the state of Iowa show with a very narrow band that about 80 to 85% of all the nitrate moving through our streams has come from a tile. And so once it's captured in that tile, can we treat it? Could we put it into a bioreactor or a saturated buffer? We now have basically, you know, our hands on that water. That's a land improvement. That's increasing the value of the land. It's increasing the production of the crop, but it's also having a very serious impact on water quality.
It keeps coming back to this issue of needing to do a better job of assessing what is leaving farms when there's not a really great way to universally know how much is going downstream.
So, you know, there's a lot of work that's happening with the Iowa Soybean Association, working directly on their on-farm program, working with farmers, doing monitoring, giving those results back to farmers. And I think that's one of the real shining stars of information coming back to an operator that oftentimes surprises them in terms of the concentration. As they continue to implement conservation, they're seeing a reduction in those loads. At a larger scale than the farm scale, the Iowa DNR runs the ambient water quality monitoring network. That is the data that provides the baseline of the nitrate load leaving the state of Iowa. That data has existed for about 25 years. That network continues on. It's about, you know, monthly or perhaps every other week sampling at very large river scales. At the University of Iowa and IIHR, we operate the nation's largest real-time continuous water quality monitoring network, sampling water quality every 10 minutes, reporting that data back. And we do that at large scales, down to kind of medium and small size watersheds, and all the way down to the practice. So we're monitoring the inlet and outlet concentrations of wetlands, the inlet and outlet concentrations in saturated buffers, so that rather than having to dig through some long technical academic report to find out the value of those practices, you can go to our online website and look at the performance of those conservation practices 24 hours a day, anytime from about the 1st of April through the end of the growing season.
You're listening to a special edition of River to River. I'm Clay Masters. This hour, we're hearing from guests Larry Weber with the University of Iowa, as well as Thomas Olander, a shrimper from Louisiana, and two Iowa farmers, Kelly Blair of Dayton in central Iowa and Mitchell Hora of Washington County. And in the second half, we'll hear more from our panelists, including discussion on crop diversity, bioreactors, and whether the water quality bill passed by the legislature last session will be enough to make improvements to our rivers and streams. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio. We'll be back after a short break.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
Welcome back. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Clay Masters in for Ben Kiefer today. We're listening to a conversation I moderated last week at Big Grove Brewery in Iowa City about water quality. You'll hear from Thomas Olander, who's a shrimper from Louisiana, as well as two Iowa farmers, Mitchell Hora of Washington County and Kelly Blair of Dayton in central Iowa, as well as Larry Weber, who's Executive Associate Dean at the College of Engineering and Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of Iowa. We'll pick things back up.
I'm curious, Thomas, I mean, what do people in the Gulf think of Iowa and the Midwest? I mean, like, what is the perception of what is going on here?
Well, they really don't have a real big perception. They don't have a real understanding of what's all taking place. It's recently, lately, that in the last maybe 2 years that I have been trying to educate our fishermen concerning the dead zone and what it's really doing, because they all just trying to figure out, why is this all happening? Why is our shrimp production so much less? Why is the size of our shrimp even smaller than what they normally are? Why are we seeing these species of fish in inland waters that we never seen before? And in the last couple of years, I've been trying to explain to them there's such a dead zone, because it really wasn't talked about that much, because we've always just been able to do well enough and we never really concerned ourselves too much with it. But since here in the last couple of years, the dead zone is growing bigger and bigger each year, and we're seeing such an effect on it that they're just asking a lot of questions of why, and that's what I've been trying to do lately, is educate them on it.
So Thomas, you know, I'm not very, you know, proud of this, but, you know, the reality of the paper that we just wrote is that, you know, about 29% of the load coming into the Gulf originates from Iowa. And if we look at the increases in load leaving of nitrate, the increases of nitrate leaving the state of Iowa is increasing so fast. If we take the Iowa portion out of the Gulf, then the nitrate load to the Gulf of Mexico would be going down. Okay, when you add the Iowa component in, it's actually going up. And so the real challenge in fixing the Gulf hypoxia starts in Iowa. And so the argument we would make, if there's federal funding available to really help the folks down in the Gulf, they should invest it in the state of Iowa.
Yeah, and that's the problem we seem to have been facing, is there is no funding for the fishermen.
Right.
We're strictly on our own. In other words, if we either make it or we don't make it. And I was hoping to bring a little attention to that there. I understand you guys have a farm plan bill, but there's no fish bill. And either we would love to get on the farm plan bill, or either let the senators or government create a fish plan bill to start funding us to keep us from going out of business. And that's one of the reasons why I'm up here, to maybe let it fall on someone's ears that may be here, that, hey, we need to help those fishermen down there in Louisiana before they go completely out of business. We're down to 5,000 commercial fishermen.
How much of this just feels like you're spinning your wheels? I mean, anybody can jump in on this. The producers, Larry, I mean, like, there's a lot of denial out there that there's even a problem from certain farmers. I mean, I've received emails from people, even a farmer in North Iowa, accusing me of spreading fake news by talking about water quality. But, I mean, how do you make change so other people, other neighbors, other farmers, other landowners step up and make a change?
So I'll
anybody
start.
Jump in.
You know, and I think, you know, we have a lot of programs like this around the state, and we get, you know, folks like Kelly and Mitchell to come out. You know, and these are poster child farmers, conservation farmers, early adopters, the folks that are doing all the right things. And when, you know, the nutrient reduction annual report comes out and they sum up the value of all the conservation in Iowa, they project about a 1-2% reduction in nitrate. And that's wonderful. But at the same time, overlay that on a 47% increase, you know, so somehow, you know, we're not getting the right information out there. We're not having the fair, open, honest, and scientific discussion. This issue gets politicized very quickly, and it becomes an urban versus rural, a right versus left. And, you know, what it is, it's an Iowa problem. And as Iowans, we ought to be able to pick ourselves up by the bootstraps and figure this out.
Mitchell, you want to jump in?
Yeah. So my take on it is, I think farmers know what these practices are. They know what needs to be done. They see the big issue. The bottom line on all this is it has to work economically. And right now it doesn't. Iowa State just put out there, it was survey data that showed that farmers across the Midwest, it wasn't just Iowa's Midwest, and there's anomalies here, but survey data showed that farmers on average are losing $40 per acre when using cover crops. And now there's a transition period to using them. We're learned about that. It's not every farmer that's losing. Some of them are losing more than $40. Some of them are making more money. But when you see, hey, here's this new practice, you should do it, but you're going to lose $40 per acre on your whole operation. And if you're a 1,000-acre farmer, yeah, $40 an acre, like my family's operation is, that don't work.
That's right.
Doesn't work because we'll be out of business too. So we have to be able to overcome that economic barrier, learn, that's the target right now, $40. How do I overcome $40? Cost share is not gonna help us get there. The cost share is available. Farmers still aren't able to do that. The cost share is $15 an acre. Okay, now we still have $25 to make up. We're still not there. We have to figure out, how do I overcome that? And I like your idea, Tom, on driving a market behind this. If we had a consumer-driven market to say, hey, we need to help make this happen. Me as a consumer, I want to help the farmer. I want to help the local Iowa farmer. I want to help the farmer who's helping Tom and his buddies. I want to buy from certain producers because they're being sustainable, because they're promoting regenerative agriculture and driving the market in that system. It doesn't take much of a economic impact when you look at it that way at all. Right now, farmers, say I'm, for simple math, I'm selling a bushel of corn for $3.50 an acre, or $3.50 a bushel. It doesn't take much more than even 25% increase to be able to really make those economics work. Not even that, 10%, to be able to say, hey, here's a premium for using cover crops, for using these things. If you look at it on the back end, so the initial upfront cost share helps, but like I said, $15 doesn't get you the whole 40. To make up for that, if you're able to sell into a sustainable market, and it's coming fast, Land O'Lakes, General Mills, Kellogg's, Campbell's are all working on it. When that's there, to be able to sell into a market because, hey, I'm doing things better, here's my commodity, support me, that really makes things interesting.
So I'm going to kind of sprinkle in some questions here from the audience as we're visiting. This person didn't write their name, but they ask if tiling is helping or hurting water quality or if there is no difference. So tiling, we've been throwing that word around. That is basically a way to control the water that's running. I'm simplifying it. Way to control the water flowing underneath, you know, that goes through the ground, the groundwater. Larry, is it helping or hurting water quality? I mean, how would you approach that question?
No, I mean, you know, this is one of the, you know, discussions that there really should be no debate on. Tiling creates a very leaky system. It moves water very quickly through the soil column. Corn doesn't like to have its feet wet, you know, is a common saying. So we put a lot of tile drainage in. That water moves quickly through the soil column and absorbs nitrate as it passes through and almost immediately ends up in the stream.
Yeah, and you don't, down in southeast Iowa, eastern Iowa, there's not as much tiling as in central Iowa.
There's a lot of tile. Almost all of the fields around here that you guys drove by on the way to get here have tile in them.
Okay.
Tile for a farmer. I'm going to keep talking about economics. As a farmer, as a young farmer coming back to my operation, I have to make the economics work. For me to be able to get into it, the rent is super high. Buying farmland, that expense is super high. I have to be able to make it work economically or it's not going to happen. Tile right now for a farmer is one of the best economic programs that you can do to improve your operation. But that does present an awesome opportunity to get the landowner involved and saying, hey, this tile is going to help this farm to produce and feed a lot more people. But let's put a bioreactor on the end of it. Let's work together to make that happen. A bioreactor costs about $15,000 to $20,000. Some of them even more than that. That's a lot of money. And right now, there's not a direct return on investment for that bioreactor. It helps a lot. It helps these guys downstream a ton. We'd love to be able to do it. That's a big expense. You can get some cost share for it, but you're still flipping at least half the bill on your own. But if that land became more valuable because it had that bioreactor, that becomes extremely interesting. Because the land in Iowa is such a valuable asset that if you can improve the valuation of that, that is huge.
Here's a pretty direct question to the Iowa farmers who are on the stage. Are you open to a buffer zone law like in Minnesota? This is something that, and Larry, correct me if I'm wrong, if you're familiar with this, I'm just kind of going off the top of my head, but this is regulating that you can't plant right up to rivers and planting more natural prairie grass along along the rivers.
50 or 60 feet.
So it's a pretty direct question. Are you open to that?
I would be open to it if the water ran through the buffer strip into the stream. In our area, it's the tile water that runs into the stream. So if we're going to spend money on taking land out of production and putting a buffer strip in, I want it to go where it needs to be. So it's where water is running into that stream. In my area, there's a berm on our, and they're dredge ditches. So they're man-made and it doesn't run through that. So it adds diversity to the farm and I love wildflowers. I'd be okay with that. But I think there are many different areas that need help. And I want to make sure that the money, any money that's put into it and mandated, I want to make sure it goes to the right place.
No, I love that answer. So there's not, for this whole water quality deal, there's not going to be one blanket fix. One Band-Aid is not going to fix it all. Cover crops isn't going to fix it all. We see that in the research, that if every acre was cover cropped or we met our cover crop goal, we still don't meet our full goal. We have to use a variety of practices here. So like Kelly's saying, let's put a buffer strip where we need a buffer strip. Let's not put it where we don't need it. And what I kind of relate back there is on your desk or on your in your house, if you were not able to use the outside perimeter at all, you had it was sitting there perfectly good, but you couldn't use it, that doesn't make a lot of sense. But if it's you need a ledge right there so your stuff doesn't fall off on that certain side, okay, that would make a little bit more sense.
Clay, as another thought, you know, a question could be, you know, because we have very detailed flood maps for the state of Iowa, including all of rural Iowa, and we do regulate the floodplain in urban areas, you know, would the landowners or the farmers here be willing to give up the land that's, say, within the 25 or the 50-year floodplain, those lands that flood, say, you know, 3 out of 10 years? Could we take those out of production? Because those lands, those wetlands, those wet soils that had fertilizer on them this spring, a lot of that nitrate went down the river. So could we think about taking the 50-year floodplain out of agricultural production?
Did you want to ask that to the farmers?
Yeah.
Okay.
I did.
Yeah, we've actually put in quite a bit of CRP in those areas that just won't produce. And I mean, that's part of talking with the landowner and making sure their goals are met too.
Yeah, I think, so we're doing a lot of looking at on-farm profitability. There's tools that we could do to map profitability for our operation. So if I have certain parts of my field that always lose me money, well then why would I keep spending money if I'm always losing it? So those kind of areas like you're saying, yeah, let's do something better. But if it's just to go out and say, hey, we're gonna take this out of production, we're buying farmland right now for $9,000. If we're gonna just throw that out the window, that doesn't make a lot of sense. But if we can strategically place those things and find the best practices to use and get it to work the economically, if I'm losing money in that spot all the time, then yeah, let's do something different. Let's use CRP, let's use pollinators, those kind of things, and help the environment all around. That'd be awesome.
Here's the question that I want to pose to Thomas, because we're talking a lot about Iowa corn and farmers, so I don't want to leave you out. They write that the voluntary nutrient reduction strategy, this is a statement that this questioner says, won't save the shrimpers. And that this is the plan for people to do more conservation practices on their land. Is it time to talk about requiring all farmers and landowners to adopt conservation practices, a more of a regulation approach? Sounds like they like it, and some of the people in the crowd.
You know,
I really don't know the exact answer on that there. I think that's more of a decision for you guys, because well, each state kind of has its own geographic, and a one law, like you said earlier, doesn't fit everybody. So I think if you guys could figure out what works best for you guys to help us out, we'll take it.
Larry?
Well, you know, I think the voluntary approach, you know, we talked about cover crops and some of the other practices today. You know, we see about 3% of the land, row crop acres, with a cover crop on. And so it's really no surprise that we're not seeing a measurable benefit from those practices across Iowa. You know, voluntary approach and also with the water quality bill that was passed through the legislature this year, the funding on it is so small that 50-year calculation that I did earlier for us all becomes 500 years or 5,000 years because we're just not putting the resources into conservation.
Which leads into another question we had, that is the water quality bill passed by the legislature last session enough to move the needle?
No.
Okay.
No, if you couldn't hear me. So.
But the farmers up here, does it feel like conversations are happening more at the state level? Does it feel like there's been change in the last 5 years, 6 years?
I think the conversations are there, and I make sure I'm there to have those conversations, but you know, it all comes down to funding, who pays for it, and it's a complicated issue because there's a lot of fingers to point. And so we all are a part of, you know, we all play some type of role, and mine is probably bigger than others. And so I'm going to make sure what I'm doing on my land is right, and I'm going to try my best. It's not going to be perfect, I can guarantee you that, but, you know, it depends on how much money is there. And every year when I go back to talk to my legislators, it's less and less to deal with. It needs to go here. I can't give it to water quality. It needs to go there. And so we need to find something that works for everybody. It needs to be a watershed approach. It can't be one size fits all.
Here's a question. What about crop diversity? If prices for corn and soybeans are dropping, should farmers be planting more alfalfa or pasture? What do you think about that, Kelly?
We actually have a cover crop field this year. We're going to combine the rye, and we're grazing some of our cattle on 10 acres of that, and we replanted to sorghum. I think what it comes down to, again, is profitability. The market drives kind of what we plant, and so if we can, you know, open it up and get more small grains, a market for those small grains, I think it's a great way to move that needle.
This is a really good question, I think, to wrap things up. For the farmers and the shrimper, what's the one thing you want people with no experience with your industry to know? And we'll start with you, Mitchell.
We understand what we need to do. We understand we have a huge battle ahead of us, and I'm excited as a young person to be able to work on that for a long career ahead. And the aim to be able to really make an impact is, how can we logistically and economically implement this stuff on our farms? And that is, hey, try it. And not just try it, just throw it out there and see what happens. You gotta do your research like Kelly did on her farm, and stick with it for a couple of years and change the culture, like you said, Larry. Change the culture on your own farm, change the culture with a couple buddies, a couple neighbors, let's pull together, let's try. You try one thing, you try strip till, you try no till, you try spraying anhydrous only. Let's see what happens, let's learn together, and we can all move forward, and let's learn. And like we said, the watershed approach is a good way to do that, but a new watershed can pop up every day when you have a group of a handful of people that say, hey, let's learn together, let's try, and let's make an impact.
Kelly?
I think also, you know, as a farmer, for me, it's overwhelming because I'm a parent, so I'm trying to be the best parent I can be, but I'm also trying to be the best farmer I can be. So, you know, tomorrow my husband has to get back to become beef quality assurance certified. We're pork quality assurance certified. We have to be certified to run a sprayer on our farm. I'm an agronomist, so I have to be certified for that. I have to know business planning to be able to have a successful business. I need to know about water quality funding and where the funding comes from and how things in the legislature are done. And just to understand that we just don't go out and just plop on fertilizer. We take soil samples. There's a lot of data involved, and it's overwhelming, like I said, for me. Maybe not for scientists. I don't know. But I think go out and visit your farmers. We're there. I want to be as transparent as I can be to show what I'm doing on my farm, to see, you know, where your beef is coming from on my farm, where your pork and corn and soybeans are coming from.
And Thomas, you're a guest in our state. What do you want people to walk away with no experience with your industry, which I think is everybody in the room right now?
This is a wonderful livelihood that I inherited, and I would have loved to pass it down to the next generation. But we're not getting that opportunity to pass our industry down to another generation. It seems like it's being cut off. I know some of you farmers here are probably taking a prod and passing the torch down to your sons and then to your grandchildren, but we're not having that opportunity to be able to do that at this time. And that's one of the reasons why I'm up here. I've made this long drive up here is to ask you to just try to help us pass the torch where our children can. It's just such a pride when you're in this shrimping business. It's just such a pride that you have. And I know you guys experience the same pride of knowing that that product is on a table and a family can really enjoy it.
You've been listening to a conversation recorded before a live audience last week at Big Grove Brewery in Iowa City. Analysts you heard this hour include Larry Weber with the University of Iowa, as well as Thomas Olander, a fisherman from Louisiana, and two Iowa farmers, Kelly Blair of Dayton and Mitchell Hora of Washington County, who is also a member of his local Farm Bureau board. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon, and Caitlin Harrop. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Special thanks to IPR's Amy O'Shaughnessy for organizing the event. The program was engineered by Jim Davies. I'm Clay Masters. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.